Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hi, I'm Scott Chesworth, and welcome to The Ancient World. Episode 13, Civil War. By 853 BC, the successive conquests of Ashur-dan II, Adad-nirari II, Tukulti-Ninurta II, and finally Ashur-nasirpal II had extended the Neo-Assyrian Empire to the borders of Anatolia to the north, the Zagros Mountains to the east, and the shores of the Mediterranean in the west. In Mesopotamia, Assyria held all lands north of the Middle Tigris and Euphrates rivers, an uncomfortable proximity that doubtless troubled the sleep of many a Babylonian king. Despite early setbacks, Shalmaneser III was determined to continue on the path of his forefathers. While the coalitions he confronted repeatedly in Syria and Canaan had courage, skill, and determination, Shalmaneser had the advantage of time. If he could not break his enemies through force alone, he could also wait until aged kings died, alliances collapsed, courage and determination wavered. And when that time came, as it surely must, Shalmaneser's victory would be assured. Another major factor in Shalmaneser's favor was that he commanded the largest and best-trained army in the Near East. Since its early foundation under Shamshi-Adad, through the collapses of both the Old and Middle Assyrian empires, the Assyrian commitment to militarism had not only endured, but grown, until it had come to permeate the entire structure of their society. All state offices were military in nature, even while including some non-military duties, and every Assyrian citizen could be called up for military service at any time. At the apex of the Assyrian militarist structure was the king, whose main role as commander-in-chief was to lead the armies of Assyria into war for the benefit of the god Assur and the state. By Assyrian custom, campaigns were to be waged yearly, and each year of a king's reign was signified by the enemies he warred against. Below the king were the highest ranks of the Assyrian military, who also typically served as governors of internal Assyrian provinces. These men were originally members of prominent Assyrian families, but by the mid-9th century BC, many had been replaced by eunuchs under the king's direct control, considered a necessary precaution against ambitious generals. Similar to other Mesopotamian states of the period, campaigns were typically fought during the summertime, when agricultural work was completed and rivers and mountain passes were easier for an army to traverse. The responsibility for military recruitment was left to provincial governors, with soldiers grouped into units of 50 men, which were then integrated into larger Assyrian forces. The provisioning of the Neo-Assyrian army with food, uniforms, and weaponry must have presented a Herculean task. All major cities of the Neo-Assyrian heartland had armories and storehouses dedicated to the purpose. In addition, conquered territories were compelled to provision the Neo-Assyrian army en route, a policy which served to extend the effective range of military campaigns. While core Assyrian forces likely numbered around 50,000 soldiers, these numbers were augmented as conquered peoples became increasingly integrated into the army. Deportees from conquered regions, in particular, were regularly used in Neo-Assyrian mobile forces that could be moved around the empire on short notice. Over time, the army came to be comprised of soldiers from diverse backgrounds and speaking different languages, a challenge that the Neo-Assyrians overcame through their usual mix of rigid training and harsh discipline. With such overwhelming military power at his command, Shalmaneser could wait for his fortunes to change in Syria and Canaan, while he turned his attention to expanding Neo-Assyrian influence in other directions. Yes, I'm looking at you, Babylonia. At the outset of his rule, Shalmaneser III had concluded a peace treaty with the aged king Nabu-apla-Edina of Babylonia. Upon his death in 851 BC, a succession dispute broke out between his two sons, and Shalmaneser decided to intervene on behalf of the king's designated heir, Marduk-Sakir-Zumi I. Combined Neo-Assyrian and Babylonian forces pursued and battled against the would-be usurper, Marduk-Bel-Usadi, at various rebel strongholds across the country. In the end, as Shalmaneser laid it out on the famous Black Obelisk of Assyria, the terrifying splendor of Assur and Marduk overcame him, and he went up to the mountains to save his life. I pursued him. I cut down with the sword Marduk-Bel-Usadi and the rebel army officers who were with him. Shalmaneser's subsequent victory tour included performing religious devotions at major Babylonian cult centers and, according to a relief from the front of his throne base, posing for a nice photo op, where he gripped Marduk-Zakir-Sumi's hand in a very public display of Assyro-Babylonian friendship. Seriously, BFFs forever, right? After his victory, Shalmaneser returned northward and led his armies against Syria again in 849 and 845 BC, but the resistance mustered by Hadad-Azer of Aram Damascus remained firm. Then, in 842 BC, King Hadad-Azer died, under somewhat mysterious circumstances, and a former court official named Hazael usurped his throne. King Hazael's first actions were to launch attacks against the neighboring Hebrew states of Israel and Judah. After taking part in the Battle of Karkar, King Ahab's reign had become dominated by matters of religious primacy in Israel. According to the biblical account, after being converted from Yahweh worship to Baal worship, Ahab gave free rein to his wife, Jezebel, to kill as many Jewish prophets as she had a hankering for. An exception to this, and an ongoing thorn in the side of the regime, was the popular and powerful prophet Elijah, who challenged 450 priests of Baal to demonstrate their power, and then successfully lobbied for their execution when they failed his test. It's not for nothing that Ahab referred to Elijah in the Bible as the troubler of Israel. I'm guessing Jezebel may have had stronger words. In 850 BC, King Ahab formed an alliance with King Jehoshaphat of Judah to attack and recover the Israelite city of Ramoth-Gilead, located in Aramean territory on the east side of the Jordan River. The war plan was cleared by several prophets, who confirmed that victory was assured. Only one, Micaiah, added the troubling codicil that Ahab probably shouldn't bother packing for the return trip. This grim prophecy shook Ahab enough to make him disguise himself as just one of the troops in the ensuing assault, but wouldn't you know it, he took a random arrow shot and died just the same. Despite his death, the city was apparently successfully taken by Israelite forces. King Jehoshaphat returned, victorious and unharmed, to Judah, where he was confronted by his own buzzkill of a prophet, named Jehu. Jehu had earlier famously condemned the Israelite king Baasha for leading his people into sin, with the end result that Baasha's entire family had been slaughtered and his throne usurped. The prophet now turned his considerable ire against Jehoshaphat, mainly for allying himself with the idolatrous King Ahab. Jehoshaphat apparently backed down and hewed to the Yahweh party line over the remainder of his reign, but also refused to distance himself from the Israelite royal family, to whom he was still connected through his son's marriage. Jehoshaphat partnered with the next Israelite king, the short-reigned Ahaziah, in a maritime trading venture that kind of went nowhere. He then teamed up with Ahaziah's successor, Jehoram, to put down an insurrection by the Israelite vassal state of Moab. This effort also apparently resulted in failure, and the eventual liberation of Moab under its rebellious king Mesha from Israelite domination. The Moabite conflict is recorded on the famous Mesha Stele, the first non-biblical source to identify the ruling family of Israel as the house of Omri and that of Judah as the house of David. When King Jehoshaphat of Judah finally died in 849 BC, he was succeeded by his son, who super confusingly also had the same name as the Israelite king, Jehoram. Jehoram of Judah is the prince who had married Ahab's daughter, making Jehoram of Israel, who was the son of Ahab by Jezebel, his cousin. Got it? No? Let's move on anyway. To complicate things further, both kings reigned over roughly the same 7-year period, though Jehoram of Judah was apparently the first to go, passing the throne down to his son, Ahaziah. The following year, between 842 and 841 BC, is just chock-full of major regional happenings, so hold on tight. First off, as I mentioned, Hazael, the new king of Aram-Damascus, decided that the time was ripe to recover the city of Ramoth-Gilead from Israel. His armies faced off against, and promptly defeated, the combined forces of Israel and Judah. King Jehoram of Israel was wounded in the battle, and in its aftermath, his nephew, King Ahaziah of Judah, went up to visit him in the city of Jezreel. Little did the two kings suspect that Jehoram's general, and apparently Ahaziah's uncle, Jehu, even more confusingly not the prophet Jehu mentioned earlier, would take advantage of the situation to launch a full-court press for control of Israel. After secretly being anointed as king of Israel by a student of the prophet Elisha, successor to the prophet Elijah, Jehu and his co-conspirators marched to Jezreel, where they immediately set upon and killed the wounded King Jehoram. King Ahaziah of Judah attempted to escape, but was also severely wounded in the assault, and died shortly thereafter, possibly within the walls of the ancient and storied city of Megiddo. King Jehoram's mother, the aged queen mother Jezebel, would not be cowed, and apparently gave the would-be usurper a serious dose of what for. In response, Jehu had her thrown from a window of the royal palace, a fatal drop, and then proceeded to run over her body with his chariot. Jehu was not one for half measures. To wit, Jehu next directed his men in the capital of Samaria to wipe out all remaining traces of Omri's line, which they fulfilled by providing him with the heads of 70 Israelite princes. Riding the revolutionary tide, which may have had its roots in popular discontent with the religious, military, and/or legal conduct of the house of Omri, Jehu rode his chariot to the capital, summoned all the priests and worshippers of Baal to his presence, then had them slaughtered en masse, and then razed the temple of Baal for good measure. As king, Jehu would eventually be succeeded by his son, Jehoahaz, who would have a more nuanced relationship with Yahweh, but let's not tell that to his dad quite yet. At the same time as the general-cum-king Jehu was consolidating power over Israel in Yahweh's name, Queen Athaliah, daughter of King Ahab of Israel, seized power in Judah upon the death of her son, Ahaziah. Her first two acts were to reintroduce Baal worship into the southern kingdom and to order the death of all of Ahaziah's children in order to secure her own hold on the throne. That last bit probably takes her out of the running for world's greatest grandma, but not to fear. One grandson, Joash, would survive the purge and eventually reclaim the throne of Judah. So for those keeping track, and as best as I can figure out, semi-idolatrous Israel was now under control of a Yahweh-worshipping ruler from the line of King David of Judah, while Yahweh traditionalist Judah was now under control of a Baal-worshipping queen from the line of King Omri of Israel. I think I'm going to need a chiropractic adjustment just to keep up. Or maybe a drink. Back in Aram-Damascus, Hazael didn't get much of a chance to bask in his victory at Ramoth-Gilead before learning that Shalmaneser III was on the march westward again. Eager to test the mettle of the new Aramean ruler, Shalmaneser launched a full-throated assault on his kingdom. Thoroughly routed by Neo-Assyrian forces, Hazael was compelled to take refuge within the walls of Damascus, where he was able to ride out a long and eventually unsuccessful siege. However, per their usual MO, the frustrated Neo-Assyrians took out their aggressions on the surrounding territories of Syria, which were utterly devastated. With their old coalition broken and its mightiest member, Aram Damascus, effectively bottled up, the remaining Canaanite kingdoms moved quickly to Plan B, tribute and unconditional submission to Shalmaneser III. Four panels of the famous Black Obelisk of Assyria, which I've already mentioned a few times, show Shalmaneser's army at the walls of Damascus, then moving westward toward the Mediterranean, at which time he received the tribute of a king identified as Jehu of Israel. The subject panel, the earliest historical depiction of an Israelite, shows Jehu kissing the ground at Shalmaneser's feet. The scene was probably chosen as a subject since Israel was the southernmost kingdom to submit to Neo-Assyria during the campaign. King Jehu may have sought the friendship of the Assyrian king as a defensive move against the Aramaeans or in a bid to shore up his recent military coup in Israel. Or, you know, there's always just trying to avoid utter Neo-Assyrian destruction. Either way, the whole tribute incident is not mentioned in the Bible. Another king to give tribute and submission during Shalmaneser's westward swing was Baal-Azer II, who had succeeded his father Ithobaal as both king of Tyre and effective ruler over all of Phoenicia. He was, incidentally, also the brother of Queen Jezebel of Israel, recently murdered by King Jehu, so it's safe to assume the two kings did not ride-share together into the Neo-Assyrian camp. Baal-Azer would be succeeded within the year by his son Matan I, whose own 8-year rule would end in 831 BC with the ascension of his son, the famous King Pygmalion, to the throne of Tyre. We'll return to the story of Pygmalion in the context of a general discussion of Phoenician trade and colonization next episode. At the end of his victorious western campaign, the holdout Hazael in Damascus notwithstanding, Shalmaneser III returned to the Assyrian capital of Nimrud, laden with the spoils of his many conquests, at least some of which he used to build an enormous new arsenal in the southeast corner of the city. In contrast to the expansionist policies of his father, Shalmaneser III did not incorporate conquered Syrian territories directly into the Neo-Assyrian state, but instead left them with their current rulers as long as they continued to provide annual tribute and obviously obeyed any Assyrian commands to the letter. Shalmaneser's focus was instead on zealously maintaining the borders established by Ashurnasir Paul II and his predecessors, essentially a recreation of the Middle Assyrian Empire. Beyond Assyria's borders lay a world that certainly had to be taught submission to Assyria, but did not need to become part of Assyria, at least not yet. The following year, in 840 BC, Shalmaneser III led the armies of Assyria northward against the Neo-Hittite states, gaining access to valuable southern Anatolian mines, as well as against the Nairi Confederation to the north. The precise chronology of Shalmaneser's subsequent campaigns is a bit hard to nail down, but highlights include winning the tribute and submission of the 24 kings of the powerful Neo-Hittite state of Tabal in south-central Anatolia in 837 BC, and waging 5 campaigns in series between 832 BC and 827 BC against the Nairi state of Urartu. Urartu was located on a mountainous plateau between Anatolia, Mesopotamia, and the Caucasus Mountains, later known as the Armenian Highlands, and was centered around Lake Van. The waters of the lake are too saline for drinking or agriculture, and the Urartians instead used the numerous rivers of the region, including the headwaters of the Euphrates, for these purposes. The high mountains and narrow valleys that characterized the landscape made travel through the region difficult, while also serving as an impediment to invading armies. Their neighbors and contemporaries, living just to the west along the southern shores of the Black Sea, were the powerful Gazga tribe, the same ones who vexed the northern borders of the late Bronze Age Hittite kingdom. The Nairi states and tribes of the region were forged into a unified kingdom of Urartu under King Aramu, who ruled over them from 860 to 843 BC. The first Urartian capital, Arzashkun, was captured by Shalmaneser III during one of his early northern campaigns. Aramu's son and heir, King Sarduri I, moved the capital to Tushpa on the shores of Lake Van. It was also Sarduri I who consolidated the military power of the Urartian state and used that power to confront and repel the series of Neo-Assyrian attacks beginning in 832 BC. One signal difference in these later Urartian campaigns is that, in a break with Assyrian tradition, they were not led directly by Shalmaneser III. After 20 years spent consolidating Assyrian control over regions reconquered by his predecessors, the once powerful king had grown aged and infirm, and resorted to handing over the command of his armies to a commander-in-chief, Turtanu in Assyrian, named Dayan Asur. At the same time, the royal bureaucracy had grown in power so as to have become nearly independent of the king's authority. Particularly offensive to the traditional Assyrian nobility was the rise in the authority of royal eunuchs, who, under Ashurnasirpal and Shalmaneser, had been granted the governorships of major provinces and even controlled access to the king's presence. In many ways, the Neo-Assyrian Empire had become a victim of its own unprecedented military successes. At first, the goal had been simply to restore Assyrian control over their own heartland. Then it was to drive out the Aramaeans living between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and reforge the Middle Assyrian Empire. But once they had accomplished all this, they suddenly found themselves to be the lone superpower in the Near East, and the small and wealthy states of Syria and Canaan became almost irresistible targets to satisfy the growing expansionist appetites of Neo-Assyrian elites. The problem was, over the course of all this, Assyria had been unable to upscale its administrative capacity quickly enough to effectively manage both the conquered territories and the vast amounts of wealth pouring into state coffers. Their new status as a hyperpower also demanded a ruler personally strong enough to exert his authority over competing power centers that now rivaled the sizes of earlier kingdoms. Toward the end of Shalmaneser III's reign, such centralized royal authority was definitely on the wane. In 827 BC, all of these factors finally led to open rebellion in Assyria. The revolt was led by Ashurnasirpal, eldest son of Shalmaneser III, and the threat it posed was considerable. 27 major Assyrian cities, including Nineveh, rallied to Ashurnasirpal's banner, and he also sought to induce the now-aged king Marduk-Zakirsumi I of Babylonia to back his bid for power. But the Babylonian king instead threw his support behind Shalmaneser's younger son and designated heir, Shamshi-Adad V, possibly in reciprocity for Shalmaneser's support during the earlier Babylonian succession crisis. Early in the conflict, loyalist forces in Nimrud erected the famous Black Obelisk of Assyria. The most complete Assyrian obelisk ever recovered, it features 20 reliefs depicting 5 subdued kings, Jehu of Israel among them, with each relief accompanied by a descriptive text. On the top and bottom of the reliefs is a long cuneiform inscription recording the annals of Shalmaneser III, essentially a list of all the military campaigns that the king, or his Turtanu, had waged each year over his long 35-year reign. The obelisk was possibly commissioned by the Turtanu himself, Dayan Asur, as both a powerful unifying symbol and an appeal to conservative Assyrian traditions in a time of growing chaos. For 7 long years, civil war engulfed the Neo-Assyrian Empire, with hardly a pause when, 4 years in, the aged Shalmaneser III finally passed away, and Shamshi-Adad V formally assumed the kingship. In the end, the support of Babylonia proved decisive, and Ashurdanipal abandoned his rebellion, though his final fate is unknown. The Treaty of Alliance between Babylonia and Assyria, agreed to in the most desperate hours of the conflict, appeared to place Assyria in a position of inferiority. But hey, you know the Assyrians, totally not ones to hold grudges. When the dust finally settled, it quickly became clear that the dynastic struggle had taken a disastrous toll on the vitality of the Neo-Assyrian state. In addition to the unfavorable treaty with Babylonia, Assyria had also lost the ability to compel tribute from its Syrian possessions. Powerful local governors and officials, including those of provinces and major cities within the Assyrian heartland, continued to flout royal authority with impunity. While Shamshi-Adad V would rule for 13 years, until 810 BC, the real power behind the throne was the new commander-in-chief, or Turtanu, Shamshi-Ilu. He would maintain his position as chief general under four Assyrian kings, would often campaign westward of the Euphrates on his own behalf, and even resolve disputes between Syrian rulers without involving the Assyrian king. In this environment, Shamshi-Adad V had to get his kicks where he could. In a little piece of payback for Babylonia's strings-attached support during the Civil War, the Assyrian king launched two successive campaigns against Marduk-Balasu Ikbi, son and heir of Marduk-Zakirzumi I. The first campaign involved a combination of lion hunting, a favorite pastime of Neo-Assyrian kings, along with widespread devastation, burning, looting, sacking, and despoiling of Babylonian cities and towns. The second, more surgical campaign, resulted in the capture of King Marduk-Balasu Ikbi at his royal capital of Ganunnadi on the Diyala River, and his deportation to Assyria in chains, along with 30,000 other Babylonian captives. In 812 BC, Shamshi-Adad V returned to Babylonia to depose their next king, a former noble named Baba Aha-Edina. After besieging him in the city of Ni, the Assyrian king managed to capture the city through the use of both siege engines and boring machines. Baba Aha-Edina was also carted off to Assyria, and in the wake of this campaign, Babylonia decided that the best way to keep Assyria out of their hair was to just not have a king for a few years, which is pretty much what they did. The following year, Shamshi-Adad V died, and the throne of Assyria passed to his son, Adad-Nirari III. Despite the persistent atmosphere of weakened imperial authority, the young and energetic Adad-Nirari III continued to launch regular military campaigns across Assyria's borders, including several against Aram Damascus. During the Assyrian absence from the region, Hazael had been mainly devoting himself to his favorite hobby of launching regular attacks against the territories of Israel, Judah, and Philistia. This included the siege and conquest of the Philistine city of Gath, recently corroborated through archaeological excavations, as well as a march on Jerusalem that compelled the current king of Judah, Joash, to bribe him with pretty much all the gold he had at his disposal. Unfortunately, Hazael took the money, killed all the princes of Judah anyway, and severely wounded Joash himself, before calling it a day and returning to Damascus. In addition to regular campaigning, King Adad-Nirari III of Assyria also tried his hand at monumental construction, through building a new temple to the god Nabu at Nineveh. But the systemic problems that plagued the Neo-Assyrian Empire were never directly confronted during his reign, and while Assyria lost none of its core territory during this period, its authority over peripheral regions could no longer remain unchallenged. One state that took up the challenge was Urartu. In 828 BC, King Ishpuwini had ascended the throne upon the death of his father, Sarduri I. He quickly moved to annex the neighboring state of Musasir and made his son, Sarduri II, viceroy over the territory, which later became an important Urartian religious center. King Ishpuwini also managed to repel one of Shamshi-Adad V's rare non-Babylonian campaigns during his reign. His successor, King Manua, who took power in 810 BC, enlarged the kingdom through numerous wars against neighboring states, and left a large number of inscriptions in the Urartian language across the region. He also organized a centralized administrative structure, fortified a number of Urartian towns, and developed a canal and irrigation system that stretched across the kingdom. In fact, several of his canals remain in use in the region to this day. The Urartians also took advantage of the period of Assyrian weakness to extend their borders southward into both northern Syria and the Zagros Mountains. The Assyrian Turtanu, Shamshi-Ilu, typically led the opposition to Urartian expansion in these regions, rather than the king himself. The Urartians secured their holdings through the construction of a series of mountain fortresses, among them the fortress of Menuakanili on Mount Ararat. In addition to exercising control over both agricultural lands and trade routes, these fortresses served as administrative centers and storehouses for grain, wine, and other valuable goods. At the dawn of the 8th century BC, these two major powers, a weakened but still dangerous Assyria and an ascendant Urartu, would continue to test each other's strength, while the other states of the region returned not to preparing to take on the eventual winner, but instead to, you guessed it, warring amongst themselves. Only one regional kingdom seemed not to be casting its gaze enviously at its neighbors, but instead out over the vast open expanse of the Mediterranean and the mysterious lands beyond. Over a century before, King Hiram of Tyre had set Phoenicia on the path to absolute dominance over Mediterranean trade. Despite the many changes in Phoenician leadership over the years, Hiram's vision was still being actively pursued. Phoenician colonies now dotted the shores of distant lands, commercial hubs that served to extend Phoenician power, culture, and influence throughout the entire region. Among these colonies was one of particular note. Founded in 814 BC, under the reign of the Tyrian king Pygmalion, this small Phoenician trading outpost on the shores of North Africa would one day rise to challenge the might of Rome for domination of the entire Mediterranean, and possibly the entire known world. Carthage and the Golden Age of Phoenician Power, next time on The Ancient World.